somewhere in Des Moines or San Antonio, there's a young gay person who all of a sudden realizes that she or he is gay, knows that if the parents find out, they'll be tossed out of the house. The classmates would taunt the child, and the Anita Bryans and John Briggs are doing their bit on TV, and that child had several options: staying in a closet, suicide. And then one day that child might open a paper and it says homosexual elected in San Francisco, and there are two new options. The option is to go to California. Stay in San Antonio and fight. And you've got to elect gay people so that that young child and the thousands upon thousands like that child know that there's hope for a better world. There's hope for a better tomorrow. Without hope, not only gays, but those blacks and the Asians and the disabled, the seniors, the us's, without hope, the us's give up. I know that you cannot live on hope alone, but without it, life is not worth living. And you, you've got to give them hope. Thank you very much.
Hello and welcome to an extra special episode of the No Good, Very Bad Gay podcast. The first of its kind, really. This is the very first episode of Queer Pioneers, a sort of mini series of episodes that I plan to release every week in addition to the main episodes, obviously, that to sort of shine a light onto our queer brothers and sisters who have somehow made an impact on the queer community. For those of you who might not be familiar with the clip that I started this episode out with, it is, of course, the famous Hope speech that was given by Harvey Milk, who I venture to guess, or at least hope that most of you out there are aware of him, if not for the fact for the film that came out in 2008 starring Sean Penn. Harvey is, of course, one of many people who I will highlight in the course of these mini episodes as we dive deep into our queer pioneers' journey. So part of my mission statement with the No Good, Very Bad Gay podcast was to, of course, talk about specific queer films that have made an impact. But in addition to the films that we cover from week to week, I think it's important for us to know more about queer history and more about LGBTQ plus history, more specifically. You know, we can rattle off facts about movies, music, TV, and, you know, pop culture that shaped us as queer people, but if I were to ask you to name five people that have made a significant impact in the queer community in the last, you know, 40 years or even 5 years, could you do it? Perhaps you could, and I would assume that the majority of us could not. And I wish it weren't that way. You know, I'm not going to be ashamed of it and beat myself up. I think that the best way to kind of counteract this is to acknowledge it and start doing some research and educate myself and take you along for the ride with me. Now, keep in mind that this is not coming from a place of condemnation or, you know, frustration with the queer community that we don't know these important men and women. I'm not accusing anyone of being less of a well-rounded queer person for not being able to answer that question, because I am in the majority of not knowing as much as I should about the people who paved the way and fought for us, and I have just as much to catch up on and learn about as you do, and I think it's high time that we dive in. So let's get started. I didn't mention your host, Nick Kachanov, and this is once again the inaugural episode of Queer Pioneers, and today we are talking about all things Pride. As you know, June is Pride Month. We're about a little bit more than halfway through it at this point, and I had planned on doing some sort of Pride-themed episode at some point, so I thought this would be the perfect platform to sort of start Queer Pioneers, and hopefully most of you will know, you know, the history of Pride, but just in case you don't, I think we can kind of start at the beginning and talk a little bit about more of the history and why it exists. So let's start with the basics. I would venture to say that most of you out there know that Pride is held in the month of June to commemorate the Stonewall riots in June of 1969. So basically what happened is back in the 1960s, the Stonewall Inn, which of course is in New York City, was one of the few bars in Manhattan where queer people could hang out, dance, and essentially exist without the police raining on their parade. And on June 28th, 1969, basically shit went down. The bar's patrons clashed with police officers in a sort of raid that would otherwise have resulted in, typical arrests. However, this time, the patrons fought back, setting off what we now know as the modern LGBT movement. So on this night, this particular night, this group of queer people stood up for themselves. It was basically the equivalent of Miss Rosa Parks not getting out of her seat on that bus. And as iconic as Stonewall was to the gay liberation in the late 60s and eventually the early 70s, it became a symbol of a largely white male movement that relegated people of color and women to its margin. Now, it's important to mention that the young women and men who sparked this revolution were not, what we typically might assume were at the forefront of this, the sort of white mask for mask males. They were trans women, they were drag queens, the femmes, the lesbians, not to mention that mostly all of these people were queer people of color that stood up to the police, who unabashedly reclaimed their place in this world and the queer community as people who matter and people who have a voice and belong. So I want to mention a couple of these people, the people that I would imagine in some circles, of course, are household names, but to most of us are not. And I want to give them this this recognition, really. So I want to start out with Stormy DeLarvier, who, and I think there is, I don't want to say different schools of thought, but in my research in this, the age-old question was, who threw the first punch? Who started this? And in most of the platforms that I've sort of been researching, Stormy was the first. She was a butch lesbian and a sort of self-proclaimed guardian of the lesbians, quote-unquote, who threw the first punch that sort of, like I said, galvanized the crowd and began the riots. She was an MC, a singer, and a bodyguard for the club that night as well. Another figure who was there that night, of course, was Marsha P. Johnson, a trans woman and one of the best-known drag queens in New York at the time. Johnson was a patron of the bar who also was one of the first people that started the movement that night, or started the action. According to one witness in David Carter's 2004 book, Stonewall, The Riots That Sparked the Gay Revolution. And just as a sort of side note, for anyone who's looking into or is interested in finding out more about Stonewall, or queer history, there is so much material out there, you guys and gals, who want to find out more about this. There are books, there are documentaries, there are movies. So if what I say today is piques your curiosity, if you want to know more about it, then by all means, find it, because it is there and readily available. But moving back to Marsha P. Johnson, she went to Stonewall that night to celebrate her 25th birthday, reportedly becoming part of the initial movement of the resistance to spark this rebellion, according to the documentary Pay It No Mind, The Life and Times of Marsha P. Johnson, which I, of course, I believe is on YouTube, actually. So if you want to find that, I have, of course, added it to my list because it sounds fascinating. And, of course, just something else that I can research in addition to this, after this episode. So Marsha P. Johnson also founded the Street Transvestite Action Revolutionaries and helped bring food and clothing to homeless trans, drag queen, or street youth. She founded this organization with Sylvia Rivera. And of course, speaking of Sylvia, she was a crucial voice in the fabric of queer activism, a Latina bisexual trans woman who was a founding member of not only the Gay Liberation Front, but also the Gay Activists Alliance. Of course, more on her. She is obviously on my list as well, of people that I want to do separate episodes on. Mostly all of the people, the men and women that I'm speaking of right now, are going to have their own individual episodes in the future. But in regards to the Stonewall riots, I just wanted to mention her activism before and after that infamous night. Another person that I want to sort of shine a light on, too, is Miss Major Griffin Gracie, reported basically that a police officer broke her jaw while she was in custody. She is now, of course, the executive director for the Transgender, Gender Variant Intersex Project, which assists trans people who are in jail. Last but certainly not least is Brenda Howard, aka the Mother of Pride. Brenda Howard is a bisexual woman who organized a rally and then the Christopher Street Celebration Day March on the anniversary of the Stonewall riots. It, of course, went on to become a week-long celebration, which basically then turned into the concept of Pride as we know it today, and why we celebrate it the entire month long. So next, I want to sort of talk about the aftermath of Stonewall. So within months after the Stonewall riots, action was already being taken in the form of newspapers being started, a citywide newspaper simply called Gay, as well as two other newspapers called Come Out and Gay Power, quickly had numbers selling in the 25,000 plus copies. Queer people were uniting together for the greater good to put a stop to the oppression that they have been experiencing. But it is important to note that this was not an easy road. There was a lot of discord that was still happening within the community and outside of the community as well, too. The police raids did not simply stop after the Stonewall riots. Of course, they continued. And out of that, like I said before, these groups were formed, the first of which was the Gay Liberation Front, that, you know, in hopes to kind of gather everyone together and come up with a plan. But there was a lot of disagreement and how basically they were unable to agree on operating procedure and how to kind of move forward and what, what their stance was and how they were going to put their words into action and move forward. And out of the Gay Liberation Front was the spawned of the Gay Activist Alliance. So basically, this was another group that had come out. But even within these organizations that were being formed, the ideas of race, class, and gender became frequent obstacles in the years after the riots. This was further illustrated in the 1973 Stonewall Rally, moments after Barbara Giddings, she gave this this speech and praised the diversity of the crowd, only to be countered by feminist activist Jean O'Leary, who protested what she perceived as the mocking of women by cross-dressers and drag queens in attendance. O'Leary went on to make this sort of speech in which she claimed that drag queens made fun of women for entertainment, value, and profit. And of course, Sylvia Rivera and Lee Brewster, who were in attendance that day, jumped on the stage and shouted, "You go to bars because of what drag queens did for you, and these bitches tell us to quit being ourselves." They, of course, were upset by O'Leary's words, and basically the drag queens and lesbian feminists in attendance left the rally in disgust. So this is one of the examples of conflict within the queer community at the time and attempts to sort of band together and lift each other up and support each other. You know, even today, there is this hierarchy of queerness that exists where trans people, drag queens, the femmes are not as understood or, in worst cases, excluded or forgotten about. You know, it is a touchy subject and, of course, something that I want to take a deep dive in later episodes of Queer Pioneers. But we need to remember that we are all fighting for the same cause. We all want equality. We all want to be valued as human beings and to be able to live as our true, authentic selves. Can I get an amen? Okay. So next, I want to go into the section where I talk about what Pride means to me. And, you know, this is kind of a two-part answer, I guess, where I can talk about the event of Pride and then actual, like, my definition of Pride and how it relates to myself and my personal development as a queer person. I am sad to report, and I hope to change this in years to come, that I've only been to one Pride ever in my life, and that is Pittsburgh Pride, and it was only last year. It was a great time. I enjoyed what I will say about the event of Pride, and I'm sure most of you know this by now and have experienced it or at least been to some sort of Pride event. And if you haven't, I encourage it because it is a place where everyone can gather and everyone can be comfortable, hopefully, in a sense that, you know, we as queer people, we go through our daily lives, most of us, I'm not going to say all of us, as an edited form of ourselves. You know, even when I was in my younger years, and still to this day, I edit myself and sort of adjust, my you know, how I move through a group and how I interact with people depending on who they are. You know, if I'm at a work event, is going to be way different from where I, how I act around like friends, you know, sitting in my backyard, like having a glass of wine. And it is something that I am working on personally to sort of become and search for my most authentic self. Like, who is Nick? And because when I came out, I came out when I was 19 years old to my parents, and it did not go well, but it did not go terribly. It was just somewhere in the middle. It was sort of a don't ask, don't tell situation. So for the next 10 years, I basically, what the understanding was, is that I told my parents, I told my brother, who was very supportive. My parents, however, thought it would just be best for my extended family, aunts, uncles, cousins, grandma, grandpa, to not know. And that was what was going to happen. And I didn't have the vocabulary to defend myself. You know, I didn't have the, you know, the nerve to sort of open up that conversation repeatedly and figure it out and walk through that fire, because it was a painful conversation. And as we know, painful conversations are not easily had. And I didn't want to start it. They didn't want to start it. So it just kind of was swept under the rug for 10 years, 10 long years. And I'm happy to say now that all of my extended family knows that I'm gay. Grandpa, grandma, aunts, uncles, cousins, and everyone. One, we all knew. They all knew, rather. And to my surprise, were very supportive, and I didn't get any shit for anything. So it's ironic that my parents, of course, were the most fearful, I guess is the best word to use, of what other people would think. Because when you come out to someone, you know, a lot of people mistake coming out as, you know, it's about the person that you're coming out to, but it's not. It's about the person that's coming out. You are showing a piece of yourself. You are telling them your truth, and that's it. That is really it. There's no explanation. There really, the idea of acceptance, unfortunately, is something that is, that is expected, I guess, that you need to, you tell them you're gay, you tell them that you're bisexual, you tell them that you're trans, and then you wait for their reaction. Yes, I accept you, or no, I don't accept this. But really, it's not about that. It's about that person sharing that with you, or with that person, the other person, and just telling them is enough. That's it. It's a very simple process. And it, of course, unfortunately, it gets turned into such a huge event, depending on who you are telling, whether it's family or friends, and having them understand it. So that you pass along to them that sort of guilt or shame or fear that you yourself had been feeling from, you know, a very young age, when you know, every single person I've ever met, a queer person that is, you know, we all know the situation. You pray every night when you're 13 years old, 12 years old, to be different, because you know deep down that you are, quote unquote, not normal, and that you, you know, you are fearful of a life that is led by, you know, a queer person or a gay person, whatever it happens to be. You pray to be different and it doesn't work. And then you say, now what? So all those feelings that you felt, you know, leading up to your coming out, you sort of transfer those onto the person. And the way that I relate it is that my parents, you know, they too have to go through the process. They have to process the fear of a child living as a queer person, and that it's, that they saw it as dangerous. You know, they didn't want me to be you know, physically harmed or emotionally harmed. So there is that sort of protection that they feel. And then also there is a little bit of shame, whether they want to believe it or not. You know, they have to tell their friends and their family too, and they have to come out in a sense to the people in their lives. So and I know that's not, this is not the case for every single person. You know, obviously, I remember when I was younger that there are parents out there that say, okay, great. And, you know, it's just that simple. It is the best case scenario. But, and I remember being so jealous of that, and my parents, that they couldn't understand. And I remember I was just so angry and full of shame. And then I was just stuck with this blanket of shame for 10 years, trying to go through college and trying to figure out where my life was going. And it's so difficult to navigate that when you feel like you are alone. And of course, you know, we talk about the idea of, you know, gay people choosing their family, the gospel of RuPaul. Hello, can I get an amen? It's you find your tribe, whether you think you need it or not, you gravitate towards those people and they become your family and they help you through it in the interim and during that time when you can't talk to your family and you can't find the words to start those conversations. It does take time, I will say that. I think that sometimes from my parents, they needed to sort of, and I don't know, I never really brought it up with them, you know, like what were they thinking in those 10 years and their journey and how they sort of came to the understanding that, you know, this was who I am and finally accepting it after 10 years. I think that most of the time it starts out with mothers convincing fathers that everything's going to be okay. I think that in my case, it certainly was, because I started dating my current boyfriend and I knew that it was something that, was going to be long-term and I was in it for the long haul. And then it was important for me, for my parents to understand that and to have him be a part of their lives in addition to him being a part of mine, that enough was enough and that I had to sort of start this conversation. It was almost like a second coming out, to be honest, at the age of, you know, 29. And so I started the conversation again, and they talked on their own a lot as well too. And eventually it sort of evolved into where we are now. But with that, you know, with, coming out and being completely out came another sort of obstacle in a way, because, you know, I had wanted it for so long. To just be free and, you know, out and I told myself, once my family knows, I'll be my true authentic self and I'll be able to live freely and not be worried about it. But I still go back to that. You know, I went to therapy for about a year and a half around this time, like 29 going into 30, to sort of unwrap that and unpack it and examine it and figure out why I was still having trouble moving forward. And, you know, it's similar, I would say, to, you know, my therapist used the sort of analogy of, you know, being in a jungle and you're used to this, you know, this shame and the fear and all the other stuff that's sort of just hugging you and won't let go, and then you're walking out of the jungle and you're able to shed that, but not all of it, and it still stays with you. And so I had to get used to this idea post coming out that you know, you still feel like you're in that, and you have to constantly sort of remind yourself, you know, you don't have to worry about that anymore. You can be you, and that is enough. But it's still difficult for me. I find ways of going back there to those places, and I don't want to. And I have coping mechanisms now that I use thanks to therapy. And I think that if anyone is having trouble with that out there, who's listening, who questions therapy or questions talking to someone else, you know, that's a licensed sort of like counselor or therapist or psychologist, to do it, because it will only make you better, and it will help you, and there is help out there. I think that's important for everyone to know. And it's one thing to have friends and family guide you through it too, but sometimes you need someone else to step in that's sort of an objective opinion to sort that out. So I got way off topic on that sort of tangent. I wanted to talk about the event of Pride. So like I said, I went to Pittsburgh Pride last year, and the idea, there's only been a few, you know, places in my life outside of like a gay bar or a gay club where I felt completely comfortable. And of course, one of them is Pride, because you have permission. You know, I think I struggle a lot with permission in a lot of facets of my life, creatively, personally, emotionally. It's a big key word for my development as a human, let alone a queer person. But yeah, you have permission to be yourself and permission to hold, you know, your boyfriend or girlfriend's hand in public without thinking twice about it. Another time where I felt that freedom, I guess, is when I was doing theater in Connecticut, and we took a trip to Provincetown. And that was another, not only was, because there was no event surrounding it, it was just how Provincetown is. It's just like this magical, you know, queer place to live, and that no one gives a shit, and that you are also, you have permission to be whoever you are and to walk down the street. And it is, for someone, you know, who has not experienced that, it's like, it's like a drug. I mean, that's might not be the best analogy to use, but it is. It's so freeing, and you want more of it. You want that all the time, and but then you go back to where you live, or you go back to your work, and you know, you go through your daily life too, and you go back to adjusting. And my hope for myself and the rest of you listening right now is to. To keep that sort of freedom and permission to be who you are every day, and it takes work. I a lot of the stuff that I was just talking about too, my sort of baggage, I would say, is stuff that I'm working on. You know, holding hands in public and not being, you know, just small things like that that you sort of build upon and work on for yourself too. Because, you know, I think of this this speech. Of Harvey Milk, and how, you know, he encouraged everyone to come out because we need people to see queer people. We need people to see gay people. We need to see that. So it becomes, the new normal. It's easier said than done because there's so much fear. You know, I'm 32 years old now. So when I was in high school, you know, there were no out people. Granted, I was like, you know, white suburbs of Pittsburgh. There really wasn't a lot of diversity to be had to begin with, let alone, you know, people coming out. But I see this, the younger generation now too, where people are coming out far more earlier, and it's encouraging. And that sort of, that paradigm is shifting a little bit too. And you see that development, and it gives you hope that future generations will finally start to normalize this and move forward. Okay, so now I want to talk about what pride means to me, and I kind of already went into it, you know, the definition of pride and being a proud, out, gay man. You know, there are these little things, as I was mentioning before, that I still go back into, and I still feel shame about certain things, you know, and it's these little things, like, you know, when I would talk on the phone at my former job that I had, and I would say that I'm from Pittsburgh, most of the, you know, the men that I would talk to on the phone assumed that I was straight and that I liked sports. And it was always this sort of, like, I wanted to say, I'm gay, I hate sports, goodbye. But I couldn't, you know, you just kind of play along. And sometimes I would just say, you know, I'm really not into sports. In Pittsburgh, that is a crime against humanity, I know, but I hate sports, so sorry about it. But these other things, like holding hands in public and you know, meeting someone for the first time and saying, you know, oh, my boyfriend and I, or my boyfriend did this. So it's just the subtle way of coming out and telling them that you're gay. Those are things that I'm still working on. You know, when I first came out, like I said before, I was not, quote unquote, proud to be gay. I was afraid to be gay. I was afraid of what my parents thought, and I was afraid of how I was going to move forward as a queer person and navigate through this world because of what my parents, you know, because of their reaction. Because no matter what, no matter how old, you still want that permission, or not permission, but you want that approval of your parents. You never stop that. But there comes a point too in your life where you have to think about yourself, and you cannot, and it's kind of a touchy subject because it's like, you want your family to be a part of your life. You want them to be, you know, included in you being a queer person and living out loud and living your truth. But you also have self-care, and you have to move forward, and you have to, I don't want to say you can't, you just say like, fuck them, I've got to live my life, goodbye. But in certain situations, if it is, you know, an abusive situation, or if you feel emotionally threatened or physically threatened, that you do have to leave. There are those stories out there of people leaving when they're 18 and not looking back and not talking to their family ever again. So The subject of pride and finding that pride within yourself is a journey, I think. And the levels of pride that you feel in certain situations, I think some people are better at it. I shouldn't say better at it than others, but have that experience or emotional intelligence or have sought out therapy and are working to better themselves can say that they are proud to be queer and mean it. And I think that is what I'm working towards when I talk about the word pride. So I want to end this episode with a quote by Michael Fader, who was just a patron of the Stonewall Inn that night. He's not an activist, but he did. I did find this quote to kind of summarize the events, and I think it's the perfect way to sort of to end this episode for one, and to think about it as we sort of honor and acknowledge the people of the past and present and future, the queer people, of course, of past, present, future, that will continue, that fought, continue to fight, and will fight for us, for the usses. All right, so here's the quote. "We all had a collective feeling like we've had enough of this kind of shit. It wasn't anything tangible anybody said to anyone else. It was just kind of like everything over the years had come to a head on that particular night in one particular place, and it was not an organized demonstration. Everyone in the crowd felt that we were never going to go back. It was like the last straw. It was a time to reclaim something that had always been taken from us. All kinds of people, all different reasons, but mostly it was total outrage, anger, sorrow, everything combined, and everything just kind of ran its course. It was the police who were doing most of the destruction. We were really trying to get back in and break free, and we felt that we had freedom at last, or freedom to at least show that we demanded freedom. We weren't going to be walking meekly in the night and letting them shove us around. It's like standing your ground for the first time and in a really strong way. And that's what caught the police by surprise. There was something in the air, freedom, a long time overdue, and we're going to fight for it. It took different forms, but the bottom line was we weren't going to go away, and we didn't." I hope that this quote serves as a reminder, or sort of your permission slip to live and be proud of who you are, not just this month, but every month after, to stand up against oppression and to do so with strength, the kindness, and empathy, but most importantly, with pride. So this concludes the first episode of Queer Pioneers. I am so excited for this project, and I look forward to learning more about the brave men and women who have paved the way for us, and I hope that you've also enjoyed what you've heard today as well. If you have enjoyed what you've heard today, please make sure to subscribe and leave a star rating on iTunes. You can tell your friends and other fellow No Good Very Bad Gays about the podcast so that they too can join the conversation. Please be sure to follow and support the podcast on social media. You can find the podcast on Twitter and Instagram at BadGayPod, as well as Facebook. And you can also email the podcast at badgaypod@gmail.com if you have any questions or comments on today's episode or what pride means to you. Let's open up the conversation. I am ready and willing to hear your stories as well, in addition to mine, as we navigate from week to week. Thanks again for listening, everyone. See you next time. Thank you.